Good morning, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to welcome you to the shock and awe meeting. I want to thank the committee for. We don't have to get into a crosstalk. There goes Hart. That's the best side of you we've seen all weekend. I want to thank Harlan and everybody for inviting me to be with you this weekend, and it's been a great conference up to this point. You guys have done a heck of a job, and you've had some great speakers, and it's just been a great weekend, and I've enjoyed myself meeting after meeting after meeting. We've heard Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to thank my lovely wife for accompanying me this weekend, and the guy that... Geez. These guys will clap over everything, and Steve, who picked us up from the airport, you know, and the first thing we did is ask Steve, you know, how you doing, you know, and the son of a bitch didn't stop talking till last night, you know. So, but you know. I'm glad to be here. I've got a lot of friends here, and there's a couple of people that love me, and they'll be here shortly. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for a little over 20 years and not amount to a goddamn thing. So if you're looking for a rocket to stardom, it ain't going to be at this meeting, let me tell you. I am just a regular goof. I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser. I'm just blue collar AA. You know, I don't have any degree or any counseling or anything like that. I'm just a guy who lost his ass, you know, and found that my head was stuck up in there, you know. But there'll be no wind blowing through that tunnel, you know. Being a loser, you know, people are always bringing people to your sides while you're growing up to compare you to. You know what I mean? You know, why don't you be like so-and-so, for Christ's sakes? And Larry, why don't you try to be like this guy, you know? And I remember being in high school, and my freshman year, I got drunk on campus, and I'm in the principal's office, you know, and he has on the back of his wall there, he's got the star quarterback, you know, old number 7, you know, and he pokes me, and he says, you know, Larry, why don't you try to be like Coy? And the next year, I was loaded on dope and got drunk on campus, and I drove the janitor's cart through the library door. I had to get that book back, and so I'm sitting in this office with my dad and my probation officer, and my dad says, "Why don't you try to be like Coy?" My junior year, I'm in the Torrance Jail, and I'm getting ready to do 90 days, and somebody slid the newspaper in there, and it says, "Coy makes all pro CIF," and I said, "Shit, I'd like to be like Coy, you know," my senior year, my sister starts dating a guy, and she brings him home. And it's old number 7 right there on my couch, you know. And my mom says, "Jesus, honey, why don't you try to be like Coy, you know?" Well, lo and behold, what goes around in old ANA comes around. It seems like I was about 5 years sober, and I'm downtown L.A., and I'm in my plumbing van, and it's a hot day. And I'm the kind of guy that people are always laying hands on. You know, or stuffing envelopes and pamphlets, you know, and have you found this guy and this guy? And, you always look like you need help, you know. And now in Los Angeles, it's vogue that on every street corner, there's some little fella selling peanuts or oranges, or he has this sign that says, "I'll work for food." Like you don't, you know. And you know, I'm sitting in my van, you know, and this guy locks eyes with me. And I go, oh, shit. You know, I got $2 and this guy ain't getting it, you know, because I'm the cookie lady, you know. And sure enough, he comes over to the van and he sticks his little head in my van and he goes, Larry? Larry Thomas? And I go, Coy. My God, you know, I thought the guy had it made, you know, and I thought that if there was any justice in AA, that maybe my sponsor or Bob could send this guy a letter saying, you know, why can't you be like Larry? you know, that's the kind of life I got. I'm glad to be here, you know. I come from a great home. I was born in Detroit. And I come out to California when I was about 3 or 4, and my mom and dad split up, and I was brought up in a little foster home, and I'm your basic poor white trash. Not too bad, baby. You know, I mean, I had no problem where I was at. I had a great mom. I had a little Scandinavian mom, and my mom loved diet pills. My mom was always eating speed. If I ever wanted any love or affection, I could find my mom in the garage around 4 o'clock in the morning sorting out nuts and bolts all night, you know. You know, and if I wondered where she was at, I could just see her past the window with the lawnmower, you know. Just... She got a hold of that gas power edger and did the whole block one night, man. She, you know, God damn it, she had a job to do, you know. And that diet was working. She was down to a stick. She was 50 pounds and all eyes, you know. Her favorite thing was to make Afghans all night, you know. She'd be clicking and clacking all night long, just putting them out, man, you know. And all the chairs had Afghans, the couches had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodles that she knit, you know. And if there's any live animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And just a busy... You go into the bathroom, you know, and sure enough, there's that poodle hiding the toilet paper, you know, and... It's got the big eyes, you know, and later on in my drinking, I started talking to it, you know, and it started talking back, you know, and her favorite thing was to take that speed and do these million piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, of the Sahara Desert, you know, and don't want to get those pieces mixed up, you know, and she'd go down to Savon's and buy a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had these coupons on the back, and she'd save these coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. Just... And she'd come home. She owned one muumuu her entire life, you know, and you never wanted her in the sunlight because you could just see all the way through, Mom, you know. And get over here, you know. And she'd come home, put on this stinky peroxide. It smelled like sewer gas, you know, and start putting together this damn puzzle. Take about 3 more dexies, you know. And she had these big pair of toenail clippers, because if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she's going to snip that son of a, you know. I got a job to do, you know. Just a busy lady, man, you know. And I had 2 sisters, and my mom would hear a cat fight and go chase after it, you know. And I had 2 sisters, and she was always chasing them around the house, because she liked to pop their blackheads, you know, and they were like running around like scared deer, you know. I remember being, you know, I've always been a little thief. I've loved to steal from anybody. It makes me feel a part of your life in a very special way, you know. And I remember rifling through the kitchen, and I remember taking a dexie or two, you know, and I didn't think nothing of it. And all of a sudden, and I'm trying to beat my eyes into the next day, you know. I ran into the garage. I closed the garage door down, you know, and I start putting together the PT-109, start sniffing that glue and looking out the window. And every now and then I'd see these black and white flashes, and that was the damn sun going up and down, you know. And I said, come out of there about 2 days later, you know. I've got these 2 sisters. I've got a younger sister who's getting all the attention because she's the baby. I've got an older sister because she's smart and good-looking, and it just makes a loser look bad having these winners around, you know. I've got a great dad. I've got a dad who's a World War II vet. My dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin, Mills Brothers, happy drunk man. And I love my father, you know. And my dad was always sneaking in and out of his own damn house is what he was doing. He didn't have keys to his own front door, you know, and because he would always be sneaking in my bedroom window, you know. Around midnight, I could feel his boot coming into that window, you know, and I grabbed him one night. I said, hey, I says, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? I mean, she's up anyway, you know. I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. Oh man, my dad reeked of responsibility and just, you know, he used to tell me, you don't know what it's like to be poor. Back when I was your age, we really had it bad. And he did. He did. His mom hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And his father chewed his tongue to death when he was a young man. And he brought up his kid brother working side jobs and stuff like that. And his dream in his life was to go into the Navy. And after the Navy, him and my mom were to move to California and live that dream. I didn't know I was going to become the nightmare of that man's dream. But he reeked of responsibility. He reeked of just being able to do things without asking for help. And I got the message that whenever, no matter how bad it gets, I never should ask the old man for help, because I got to do it myself to show him that I'm a man too. But the thing that I couldn't convey to my dad was how frightened I was and how much help I needed. I remember the thing that I hated the most about being a kid was the old man would always take me to the barber shop, and I hated getting my hair cut. I felt like I was being neutered, you know. I mean, I hated it, you know. And I remember being a young man and holding my dad's hand on the way to the barber shop, my first trip to the barber shop. And as we got to the barber shop, he let go, and I felt so lost and alone, you know. And I never forgot how that felt. I never forgot how it felt to be about 9, 10 years old and dreaming about having a baby brother, and my dad coming into that room and saying, you're going to have a baby brother, and saving up my baseball cards and oiling up my glove and planning for that kid brother, and having my dad come into that room and tell me that my baby brother died. And I didn't have any ounce of compassion for my mom or wondered what was going on. But what happened to me is nobody told me about death. I'm a little kid thinking I'm going to live forever. I didn't know what happens to that, you know, and I got scared to death of this thing called a God, because what kind of God would create you and kill you? And what that did to this lazy young man was that whenever I would find myself putting about 20 or 30% effort into doing something, I would talk myself out of it with the thought being, what the hell, you're going to die anyway. What's the use? You're going to die anyway. What's the use of doing this? What's the use of trying? And I had that going on in my head, my ego was being satisfied as a young man, because I was good in sports and I was sociable and I wasn't locked up in a closet, you know. But it seemed like the older I got, the more scared that I got. And I didn't know how to talk about that. I didn't know how to tell the old man that, man, it's not that I don't need directions on whether to go into the Navy or something like that, but I need to tell you how afraid I am. I need to tell you that I don't feel like those kids, that I can play baseball with every one of them, but when I get home, there seems to be a part of me missing, that I'm always restless, irritable, and discontented. I'm always looking for the peace that's going to make me whole. And around 11 years old, there was four of us, and we stole a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, it turned Howdy Doody into James Dean in two drinks. I found the piece that was missing. All my buddies were thinking about what they were going to do when they grew up, and I just found out my answer. I was going to be leaning on this stuff for a long time, man. And I didn't have to worry about anything. And it wasn't hard to get. It wasn't hard to find. And I started drinking at an early age, not to get drunk, but just to get away from the way that I felt when I was sober. You see, if you're new, I urge you to get a sponsor. And if you don't know what a sponsor is, years ago in the racing industries, these dragsters were going so fast that the front wheels were leaving the ground and they were killing the drivers. And so the engineers got together with these guys and they designed a thing that goes on the back of these race cars that no matter how fast it goes, its front wheels are on the ground. And they called it a spoiler. Hence the name sponsor. Get yourself a spoiler. who doesn't care how fast you're going, but is concerned that your feet are firmly in the middle of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Because I guarantee you, hold off. I guarantee you, just because you're getting sober doesn't mean you're going to be wonderful. I used to come to these meetings and I'd see these guys with these ties on saying things like, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. You know, my God, I came in with that guy, you know. Get yourself a sponsor. Get yourself somebody that you can... I tell you, and that's what a sponsor is for me. We hear a lot about sponsorships, and a lot of times I get confused. But I tell you what my sponsor did for me. He didn't give me any answers. What he did is he helped me get my life in order. He got my house in order, and the answers came. He didn't give me anything handed out. He made me get into that book, and the answers came about by getting my house in order. And as long as I'm trying to get my house in order, great answers will come to me. He made me work, earn my sobriety. There was nothing that was handed out. And I'm a taker. People have been handing me my life my whole life. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I wanted the same thing. I thought this was another group of people that was going to be like a relief fund or the long arm of the Salvation Army or someplace I can just kick back and use up and they'll give me. And if you're new, get prepared to be done with alcoholics. What you've been doing to people your entire life, we're going to use you. Be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life. And the most heartbreaking thing that we can see is when these people are new and they're trying to get sober and hang around your old chums. There's nothing worse. Get around the people in Alcoholics Anonymous because you're a creature of habit. And if you hang around the people that are doing the things in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're in safe grounds. Because when your buddy's feeling goofy, you can drag him along. And when you're feeling goofy, he can drag you along. But for Christ's sake, you're dragging each other to the same place. Alcoholics Anonymous, man. You know, get yourself a couple people that you can talk to about your sponsor and see if that son of a bitch is telling them the same thing they've been telling you, you know. Chances are he is, you know. And I started drinking at an early age and I loved it because sobriety drove me to drink time and time and time again. I couldn't stand the way that I felt when I was sober because I knew what I was. I was a frightened, scared, insane person, and I didn't know how to tell people how afraid I was, how abnormal I felt. I was so ashamed of the way that I thought, that I knew it wasn't right, you know? And around my freshman year in high school, I found a group of people that made me feel more a part of life than anything that I've ever felt, and it was the lowriders. And I love the lowriders. What we used to do is we used to get our hair up real high and lower our Chevrolets real low. We'd bounce around and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck a couple days ago, and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn truck. I loved it. I had a Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she used to curl her hair up real big, and she had a teardrop right here, and I'd get my hair up real big and my white T-shirts and my black khaki pants, and we'd bounce around all day drinking that white port, wondering what the hell you're staring at, you know. Now I know, you know. Now I know. I remember not too long ago I was in the Glendale Mall, you know, and a kid walked by, and he was lost in his images. He was completely bald. He was tatted down. He had a tank top on. He had these big pair of pants that you could put about five guys in. He had four beepers because he was an important kid. I walked by him. He had his mom's earrings on. He had his nose ring on, chained to his lip ring. He had his lip chained to his wallet. I walked by him. He goes, "What the hell are you looking at?" I says, "I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at." You know, he opened up his mouth. He had a ball bearing. I thought the son of a bitch was going to start up on me, man. Everything was hooked together. I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40, you know. Now I sponsor the guy. He says, what do you want me to do? I says, unlock yourself for Christ's sake, you know. Try that for starter, grow some hair, you know. But I understand that. And when you're driving around with those guys, you always got to do something to get in with the gang. And there was this guy that stole a bag of dope from us, and we were all going to look for him, you know. And there's, you know, we look like the magic dwarfs. We all look the same. We're bouncing around in there. We got the frowns on because our ass hurts from bouncing around all there, you know. And I'm in the back seat, and the more Jack Daniels I'm drinking, the bigger I'm getting, man. My hands are getting bigger, and Jesus Christ, man, you know. And I've got this pipe in my hand, and we're all planning, and I'm thinking these guys are going to help me get this guy. We drive into the liquor store, and this guy's in the back lot, and this guy's a Samoan fella, and he's about 6'10". He's about 350 pounds, and his feet are this thick, you know. And I go running after the guy, thinking I'm going to hit him with the pipe, and that I've got my buddies behind me. And it seems like everything that bad that happens to me happens in slow motion, you know, that the good things are just clicking on by, you know. And I go running after this guy, and I see this pipe fall out of this magazine. Now, I'm going to go kick this man's ass with a Life magazine, you know. I'm going to swat him back to Sonora, you know. I mean, this guy kicked my ass for 5 days. I was seeing chunks of stuff going, flying everywhere. And the only thought that I had is when he's done, I'm going to kick his ass, you know. I loved it. I loved the effects produced by alcohol. Because I wasn't that goofy kid. I wasn't Betty and Bob's little boy. My dad had a nickname. He called me Boober. I don't want to be Boober. I want to be Speedy. I want to be Wetto Loco, but I don't want to be Boober, you know. Anything but Boober, you know. And I tell you, man, I bounced off into the sunset. I knew that I had found my lot in life, and it was going to be in that Chevrolet, man. And I remember being about a sophomore in high school, you know, and everybody's taking driver education class like you haven't driven before, you know. And I'm taking summer school because I'm always getting kicked out of regular school. And so it's my turn to drive. So the teacher says, all right, get in the car. It's your turn. So I get my hair into the car, you know, and about five guys in there, you know. And he says, pull up to the corner over there and parallel park. So I parallel park. And he says, well, you seem to be doing okay. He says, why don't you drive to Torrance Boulevard? We're going to go to the Jack in the Box. I'm going to buy everybody some Pepsi. Well, what a cool coach. So I drive up to the Jack in the Box, and I totally forgot that 15 minutes before class, I took four of what they then call Tylenols. And I just been a good little wino doing some heroin, and I'd never taken any of these things before, you know. And they're half Seconal, half Amitol. You're knocked out telling the truth is what you're doing, you know. And every Al-Anon's dream, you know. So we pull up into the Jack in the Box, and these things nail me. I go, Jesus Christ, I can't. Now there's four coaches sitting over there, you know, and I can't talk. And he goes, well, drive up and order some Pepsi. And he says, go talk to the puppet. Well, I can't see the puppet, you know. I'm doing that one eye thing, you know, trying to look for the puppet. And all of a sudden I hear this bang, and this puppet's head's hanging over, you know. And, can I have your order, please? That kid's in there begging me to talk to him, you know. I want to talk to him. I want him to come out and be my designated driver is what I want him to do. The cops come. They throw me on the hood of the car. They shatter my hair everywhere. And I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal. There's nothing like driving shotgun. Let Rudy drive all night, you know. And, you know, when you're driving shotgun, man, the miracle of miracles happen, man. You're drinking that white port and you look in that mirror and you go, Jesus Christ, are you good looking? My God, they don't make them better looking than you. Your hair's getting bigger and your eyes are getting bluer. And my God, you ought to be an underwear model for Christ's sakes. You don't wear any, but what the hell, you know? Had it made, man. Had it made. You look in that mirror, you got some cigarette butt stuck to your head. You got some vomit stuck to your tank top and you feel foxy. Yeah. I feel a dance coming on, you know? Oh, I loved it, man. I loved it. I love going to those bars, man. I love going to those bars and finding the nut for that loose bolt. I mean, and they were in there. They're in here tonight. I mean, they're here, you know. We've been with them all weekend, you know. And I love the effect produced by alcohol, man. I love the way it made me feel. And around 1969, all my buddies are going places, and I don't... I don't know what to do with my life, and so me and my buddy go to Arizona, you know, and I'm on my way. I thought, well, maybe I'll go to Detroit and find my roots, and I land in Arizona, and I'm over off of North Central and Buckeye Road. I'm at the Apache Hotel, and we're overlooking the Wagon Wheel Bar, and I'm getting these jobs at Volt and Manpower, and I'm afraid to leave my room. And every now and then I get an idea, man, and I ran into this guy down there, Ernie was from Tennessee. And Ernie said, I know how we're going to make some money, Larry. He says, you're going to be a jockey. We're going to get you down to 95 pounds and take you and get your colors, you know. And all right, I'm into training, you know. And he says, now, what we're going to do is you need to take this. And he gave me a bag of meth. And, you know, he says, I'll be back in 2 months and we'll weigh you in, you know. And the guy comes back 5 days later and I'm stuck in the same doorway. I'm going faster than any damn horse I've ever seen in my life, Ernie. You know, you can put a saddle on me and ride me to kingdom come, baby. You know, and when you're at that stage of your development, anything that falls on the floor, you're smoking. Oh, yeah, it could be a toenail and you're lighting that thing up, you know. Drinking that whiskey and dreaming and dying all day long, man. Dreaming and dying all day long, man. Afraid to leave that room. Afraid to go out there. You don't go anywhere without a shot. And after about a year there, we hooked up with some people, and I fake a knee injury. I'm digging a ditch for a guy, and we get a prescription, and we start running these prescriptions down Tucson and stuff like that. And after about a year and a half, they caught up with me. And when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase. You know, there he goes down to 605. You know, there's none of that. It's just a matter of the sheriff coming into your motel room and going, well, there he is under there, you know. You know, always butt naked. Leave it to the alky, man. No matter how they find us, that alky's going to be butt naked, man. There's something about that. I spoke at a conference not too long ago in Bakersfield, and I was sharing the hotel with some Jehovah Witnesses. I had this sneaky desire to get a grapevine and knock on every door about 3 o'clock in the morning. Just to ask him if they knew Bill and Bob loved him, you know. Just to see if how many of them answered the door butt naked, you know. And so they convict me, and I come out of there at about a year and a half. In 1974, they meet me with a $45 voucher and a Continental Trailways, and I come back to Los Angeles. And at this time, my drinking ceased to become a luxury, you see. I love that part in Doctor's Opinion where it starts saying that the only answer that we have is entire abstinence. And the immediate paragraph says, this starts a seething cauldron of debate. You bet. Because we've been abstinent before. And abstinence seems to drive the alcoholic mad. Alcoholism strikes us when we're sober. I wish that we could just stop drinking. And I wish that there was a circumstance. I wish that there was an amount of love. I wish that there was a necessary situation or a wish, whether it be in mine or yours, that could stop me. But the nature of the alcoholic is that no matter what your state of mind or condition or what your bottom is, it'll never be enough to keep you sober. I am not here tonight because of hitting a bottom, and that's what sustains me. Hitting that bottom is what motivated me to do things that I knew would never work for me. It's been my motivator. You see, because the longer I stay sober, that bottom don't seem to look that bad because of the pain that I feel when I'm sober. And if I'm going to feel this crappy, I may as well drink. I've got a 50-50 chance. I've got some good bourbon here. The only time I ever sobered up is to get that stuff out of me to get a fresh drunk going. You know, get all that stuff out and get a nice new one going, you know. And no matter what my circumstances, no matter what it is, no matter what gurney I'm on, no matter what emergency ward, I'm sitting there and the only thought that I have is going to Eddie's liquor store when I get off this table. You see? I'm the kind of guy who did a year and a half somewhere, sometime, and all my buddies are talking about what they're going to do when they get out. And I'm thinking about the half pint that I hid on Crenshaw Boulevard. That's keeping me on a daily, that's my goal. And I think about that half pint. I think about how I'm going to find it under that tree. And I get let out of that institution. And I start tearing up every tree on Crenshaw Boulevard looking for that. You see? Because I had a dream. And it kept me, in that institution for a long time, just thinking about that thing. And in 1974, I'm in a little league dugout. I'm over there in El Segundo. And I'm in between, and I've got two months sober, and I got my antabuse going, and I'm in between hysterical and maniacal, which is the only comfort I find when I'm sober. And I'm in a little league dugout, and the landlady calls the police on me, and they come over there, and they take me to the Harbor General Hospital, and they see that maybe I need to go to a state hospital for 30 days and be observed, because it may be some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts, and because of what my record says and stuff. And they sent me to a state hospital. And they observed me for damn near 12 months. And I came out with every little bag of anti-anxiety and antidepressant and anti-this and anti-that. Anything I need to make me feel different was in that bag, with the guarantee that I wouldn't be able to operate out in society unless I took these little goodies. And they had me, because I believed them. I knew I was goofy. And after 2 months, they proved that they were right, because I got... 2 months I ran out of Thorazine and I got drunk. And I wound up over there on Alvaro Street in downtown Los Angeles. And they picked me up, not for being a big time con. I'm a punk scared man. And I'm curled up in a little corner in Alvaro Street. And they picked me up for being a drunken public nuisance. They rolled me up and they sent me to Wayside. And I'm up there on Wayside for about 30 days. And they put about 50 of us in a black and white bus. And they sent us down to the South Bay Courthouse where I'm going to be tried and convicted. After 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm in a holding tank about the size of one of these little hospitality rooms. And there's just me and bologna sandwiches and all the buses are gone. And I got my Vons bag and no hope. And I'm wondering where I'm going now, because they're always sending me somewhere. And in 1975, a Scottish man with a patch stuck his head in a jail cell. And he said, "Are you Larry Thomas?" I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He said, "Come with me, son. You're going to AA. AA? Well, there's two initials I've never heard of before. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's an AA, you know? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? Aye, lad, you know? And for 15 minutes, that guy was your biggest cheerleader. For 15 minutes, that guy took me in a little lime green Plymouth, and he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he could have killed me. You know how he could have killed me? He could have lowered his car and pierced his nose and put on the four tops and had me go spray in the walls with gang writing just for me to feel a part of AA. He could have talked that street nonsense to make me feel a part of AA. But he didn't. He was a man of principle. He was a man who was like the people in this room, who knew what was going on here. He knew that if there was any changing to be done in that car, it wasn't going to be him. And that man didn't, he said he was going to take me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me the thing that, if you're new, I want to tell you and share with you, that is this. That if you're feeling different and you're feeling separate and you don't feel like you belong, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that man with that Scottish patch, that man with that patch told me something that saved my bacon that day. He said, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are. He says, nobody comes to Alcoholics Anonymous happy and well adjusted. That's what the Al-Anons feel when you're here. And he didn't say, come to these meetings and when it gets time to read the traditions, you can clap. He didn't say, when it comes to read the steps, you can chant. He told me to come to these meetings because some of these meetings to some of these people is the only hour and a half peace that they find, because they're alcoholics of our type who out there, they get restless and irritable and discontented because they're doing the unnatural for the alcoholic. They're out there being one among many. And they don't know how to do life, and they get restless and irritable. And sometimes the only hour and a half of peace we find is when we're in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we need to hear the traditions, and we need to hear Chapter 5. So we don't mock our meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because for some of us, this is the only meditation we get all week. In that 11-step prayer, old St. Francis hit it right on the button. Make me a channel. Where there's discomfort, help me comfort. Where there's lack of understanding, help me understand. If we don't feel that in our AA meetings, what kind of stuff are we passing around here? That's exactly the atmosphere of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Now, how can you feel that when people are going, squawk? How can you feel that when they're chanting the very thing that's saving your bacon? Take care of your Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and it'll take care of you. And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. He took me to the TLC Club in Torrance. He introduced me to a little lady named Moose and Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Santa Claus Ray and Biker Ray. Biker Ray is here right now. He works in central office. He came up to me last night and I damn near shit my pants, man. I said, my God. That guy seen me when I come in, man. And that guy saved my bacon because no matter how goofy I was saying or what I was feeling, he wasn't shocked. And he wasn't in awe. Because he was an alcoholic and all he said, yeah, I felt that way too. You see what I'm saying? It was eye to eye. It wasn't looking down on you. It wasn't me looking up at him. It was one alcoholic talking to another. He wasn't shocked about my behavior. He understood how I felt and he told me what to do about it. And I came into that meeting in 1975 and I met all these people. Little Moose was from Tennessee and she come running after me like a toilet paper. She said, hi honey, my name is Moose and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are, Moose. I said, I'm not it, you know. There was this transvestite and he was in the card room and he comes circling me like a helicopter, you know. About his third time around, he says, I want to take you to a candlelight meeting. I said, I don't think so. Not for my first year anyway, you know. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of alcoholics on a regular basis. And that don't make me special. That don't make me more of an alcoholic or a worse member. Doesn't make me a better member. All it does is prove to me one point. That coming to these meetings and getting physically sober will just make me mentally ill. That if I don't do something about this thing called alcoholism, then I'm a dead man. That if I don't start doing the uncomfortable to get comfortable and stop looking for the convenient things to do in my Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a dead man. That it wasn't about people handing me a plate with the answer on it. It was about me putting something in that basket called money by me going out there being self-supporting, not from the state, not on medication. If you're on medication, keep the black bands on so we know where you're at. And he talked to me about being, and I love my sponsor. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out. In 1980, I'm up at a hotel. I'm at the Don Hotel. I'm about 3 weeks sober. I'm watching Jeopardy so I can really feel like an idiot. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. I got a PM bourbon bottle cut in half. 10 o'clock in the morning, I hear this, Larry, it's Don. Jesus Christ, it's that guy from AA. You know, I didn't even call him and he's coming over here, you know. And he opened up the door and he says, oh my God, you had 15 days. You had 15 days, Larry, you're going to be a janitor in the city of Lameda. There's some hope for you new guys. He says, what's going on? I took a shot off of that bourbon bottle and I told Don, I says, I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. If I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Just get the heck out of my room and let me do what I want to do. The cry of this alcoholic for my entire life. Let me do what I want to do. It'll be a cold day in hell before I get another man a cup of coffee in an AA meeting. Nobody's going to tell me how to do it. And the moment that guy left my room, I'm stuck with the memory of you. And if you're new and you're having trouble staying, you may leave us, but we'll never leave you. Because the seed's been planted. And if you're not alcoholic, don't worry about it. It's only planted in alkies. And that guy left my room, and I'm stuck with the memory of you. And I couldn't get you out of my mind. And from 1980 to 1982, I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober because they felt the same. There was no relief. I would love to tell you that it stopped working and I come to A&A. My head don't care. My head don't care if it stopped working. My head's got a job to do, and that's to get me loaded on a daily basis. It could care less the information that it gets. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me for a little over 20 years is you took the only decent thing I had, you trained my feet. So that no matter what my head's telling me, I'm in the shower and I'm going, I'm not going there. I'm not going. Nope. Harlan's going to be there. Vera's going to be there. Daryl's going to be there. I'm not going. I'm not going. I'm not going. Hi, my name is Larry. I'm an alcoholic. Just like driving into Eddie's Liquor Store every day at 5, boy, you know. My head is trained what to do on a Monday and a Wednesday and a Friday night and a Thursday book study. It's trained to do certain things on certain days because I know how goofy I get. You know, I know how goofy I get. And I can't shut my head off. Sometimes I got to put it in the back seat just like a mother-in-law and just every now and then go to my meetings and talk to it every now and then, you know. Get to my meeting, you know. And on May 2nd, 1982, I walked into the Beacon Light Mission over there at Wilmington. I want to make this quick so we can go to our airport. And I caught eyes with the Thing, and the Thing is 135 pounds, and he's yellow. His eyes are cut, and his hair is down to his butt, and he's got that street mud from the inside out. And I lock eyes with the Thing, and I said, "My God, whatever happened to my dreams?" And I checked into the mission, and I did what I always did when I got that. I panhandled some money, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I get Don. "Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the mission. I'm ready to come to AA. Will you come and get me?" And he told me the most profound thing he's ever said in my life. He said, "No." He says, "You know where we are. You know what we got. If you want to get sober, get your rusty rear down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you." And I said, "Whatever happened to that AA love, you know?" And I took the longest walk of my life from Wilmington to Torrance, and I showed up at that club. And I walked in there, and they asked me what I was doing there. And I said, "Well, if it interests you," I says, "I'm looking for Don." And they said, "Well, he's over there." And I waddled over there with my poopy pants and my street mud on, and I asked that man something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't ask him for a dollar, and I didn't ask him for a handout. I said, "Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor?" And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds, and then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. And he told me under no certain terms is he going to put up with my nonsense, that if you make the effort, I make the effort. And it wasn't my longest drunk, and it wasn't my worst drunk, but it was the drunk that drank away the debate of whether I was going to do these things with you or not. Because I'm powerless. Every time I got sober, I would say to myself, "I'm not going to drink." That didn't happen this last time. That morning when I woke up and I went to see Don, I put my feet on the ground and I said, "I'm going to drink. If I don't go see this guy, I'm going to drink. I know I'm going to drink." And there was one thing that I couldn't deny, that whenever Ray or Don would come and see me, they would look at me and they would leave that hotel this high off the ground for one reason and one reason only. They weren't me. Yep. They'd take one look at me and go, "Boy, AA's working good in my life, man." And, and from May 2nd, 1982 to this very instant, I've been surrounded by Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had to go anywhere else. There's a man that... It's not so much that we have found an answer to our special problem. I believe the most beautiful thing that we have here is that we have found people who are contagious about the wonderful way of life they've found here. This contagion of the spirit about the solution that they have found here. We are happy about this way of life. We have come. And the journey is ended through hell that we have lived in our entire life. That journey is over. And now the life that we've always wanted can begin. And it can begin right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It can begin by taking that inventory with that man and letting those two people off the hook, my mother and father. I used to bang around my mom till I got blood out of her nose, demanding that she come up with a bottle. I used to hate to be around that guy called my father because I reeked of weakness. And what a great privilege it is to be with that man when I'm sober and have that guy become my best friend. What a great deal it was the last 2 years of his life to see that 240-pound refinery worker whittled down to 90 pounds because of his cancer. But I got to go there and take care of that man and clean that man and be that man's son because it was my great privilege to be his son. As it is my great privilege to be my mother's son. One of the best things about sponsorship is getting these guys back to their family. Not rushing them off and paying their dope dealers, but getting them back to their father's house. Getting them back to their mother's house. Getting them back with their children, where we belong. What a great feeling that is. What a great feeling that is to, at the every end of every meeting, a guy like me can hold hands with men like you and not be shocked anymore because I'm touching a man. And when it comes time to show my dad love, affection, I can kiss him on the head and not be shocked and not feel weird. Because I've been holding your hand at the end of every meeting. I've been kissing you on your birthday and you've been hugging me. You see, you've taught me how to live this way of life so well that most of the time I feel undeserved. Most of the time I'm living a dream here. What a privilege it is to have a sponsor and a home group. My home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. And I love my home group because that's my home. I love the atmosphere of my home group, how we recreate that atmosphere that was created for me. So when I came into these rooms, the people were happy, joyous, and free, and they all had jobs, and they were all taking a part of their Alcoholics Anonymous because they weren't waiting for their God. They were taking a part of their God by cleaning their meetings and setting the meetings for a guy like me to come stumbling into this atmosphere called AA. You see? What a neat thing it is to have a sponsor show you respect for the thing that's saving your life. I'm not wearing a tie because I think I'm sharp and effective. I'm wearing a tie because you taught me how to get it. You taught me how to go out there and get a job and pay my bills and pay my child support. You taught me how to go out there and not duck my head anymore. You taught me how to go out there and make these amends with my mother and father and the financial amends, you see, and get that house in order for these answers to come. The women in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be with my wife and how to be with my daughter who I wasn't supposed to see after 5 years sober. I wasn't supposed to see my baby Lauren, you see. Because the man can't hold a job and he's got a secret. And then at 10 years sober, my baby's jumping up in my lap and she's looking me in the eye and she has holes in her socks and holes in her underwear because her dad can't hold a job. And she looks at me in the eyes and she says with her eyes, "Daddy, if you love me, why do you dress me this way?" And I knew I had to talk to my sponsor about holding a job and how to hold a job. And my sponsor taught me that. He taught me how to, as long as that guy's name is on that truck, your job is to make him money and to be a service to his customers. You see, what are you going to do with a guy like me? Alcoholics Anonymous made me a plumber. They stuck me in the, they took me out of the gutter and stuck me in the sewer is what they did. And that little girl that I wasn't supposed to see, you know, an amazing thing happens when you pay child support. Great events will start to come to pass, man. And I'm in good relations with that first wife. And my daughter, if I can go to Portland, I can go to Phoenix and see that little girl. What's more spiritual? And I see that girl on an ongoing basis because the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me to start writing that little girl every week and start calling her. And you don't write her on yellow piece of paper. You write her on Pocahontas paper. And that little girl is 15 now. And she sees her dad on a regular basis. And that little girl is getting ready to go to college because she's so smart. She calls me up and she says, "Dad, the kids are making fun of me because I'm so smart." She says, "Has that ever happened to you?" And like any good alky, I said, "Yeah, hell yes, it did." I called her up the other day. I says, "What are you doing?" She says, "My boyfriend's over." I says, "What's he doing over there?" She says, "He locked himself out of his house." I said, "Who is it?" She says, "It's Jason." I says, "What's Jason doing?" "Oh, he this and this and this." I says, "Does he got any tattoos?" "No, but he's got a lip ring." I says, "Well, have him put his house key on his lip ring, for Christ's sake, you know." And then 5 years ago, I'm speaking in Downey, and I lock eyes with a brown-eyed Nicaraguan. And I couldn't keep my eyes off her. And at the end of that meeting, I was talking with her, and I had to get her phone number. She says, "Do you like the backpack?" I says, "I love it." I haven't backpacked my entire life, you know, but anything to get into the tent, you know. And I've been carrying her pack for 5 years now. I love that lady. And the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be a husband to that lady. They taught me how to hold a job, and that if I go into a home and I see that there's dirty dishes, to go ahead and grab a sponge. That I don't go there demanding things to be ironed and things to be done. That if there's some things that need to be done in my eyes, you better get done doing them. She ain't there to serve you as a butler. You see, you taught me how to treat people with respect. See, alcoholics of my type have always demanded it. That's because we didn't know how to give it. And once you start giving respect, you quit looking for it. You quit looking for it. You see? A young man came to a guy in a lighthouse. The little boy went to the man in the lighthouse and he said, "You ought to be lonely in here." And the old man turned to the kid. He says, "Not since I've saved my first life." You taught me how to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous and that it ain't about getting. I didn't come to Portland to get a damn thing. I don't go to prisons to tell these guys and to get things off of their way of life, to get grateful because a man's doing time. I should come here to share the gratitude that you've been given. You've given me a way of life, that the journey is over and the life has just begun. And what a great pleasure it is for me to be a part of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and share this lovely weekend with you. Thank you so very much.